kids. Matt Segundo here, and I'm here to tell you that I can relate to the story of Oven Man, because you see, at one point low in my life, I too once worked in a pizzeria. There, I was asked to wash dishes, something I had never been asked to do. I figured that washing a dish was no different from washing a car, so I took the stack of plates outside and watered them down with a green garden hose. Needless to say, there was a plate shortage, and I was asked to leave without pay. So I admire all those brave souls who work in pizzerias. Perhaps they know something about the ways of the world that I simply cannot grok.
Okay, so I am here with Jeff Parker, who is the author of Oven Man, and we're actually sitting here with pizza. Jeff, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Where do we start with this book? I think I should probably ask you if you... I know you grew up in Florida, but I'm wondering if you actually worked in a pizzeria. I wanted to sort of ask you this question along with... I'm not sure if you're familiar with John Shepherd's Small Town Punk. But
I haven't read it, but I've heard of it.
There are a lot of similarities between your book and Small Town Punk in the sense that both depict working class life, and both also involve a pizzeria. The main character works in a pizzeria. So what is it about, I suppose, the pizzeria that lends itself to exploring this particular milieu, to use a pizzeria word?
Is it set in a pizzeria?
I think you can say that in a pizzeria.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
It is set in a pizzeria, yes.
Yeah. Well, I did work in a pizza place for many years. I worked in a bunch of restaurants, so... I don't know, it was the natural place for me to set something because it's sort of what I knew, mm-hmm. you know? And, well, it just seemed to me that there's lots of books and stories and whatnot about waiters and waitresses and a certain kind of restaurant, and all the restaurants I'd worked in had never really been represented. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't have any data on this, but I bet you we could say that 75% of the population of America works in a restaurant at some point.
Or the service sector, for that matter. It's interesting, too, because you don't really see work, particularly this type of work, explored so much in fiction. Why do you think that is? And does your book sort of, I guess, work in its own way to fill the gap?
Well, I've been told the sections that describe the work itself are pretty tedious, so maybe that's the reason.
Yeah.
I mean, lengthy descriptions of mopping a floor... For whatever reason, they didn't put that on the jacket to sell it, so...
Yeah. But, I mean, it does tie into this character's life, who also has a very unusual name, Wen Thinfinger. How did that name come about? And maybe we can start talking about some of his problems. If we were to sort of, I guess, be reductive about this book, it's almost sort of a work versus love scenario and the interconnection in between.
Yeah, maybe, or he loves his work so much, he doesn't have much room in his life to love other things adequately, so...
But he does have a work ethic, which is very interesting in light of the many mistakes that he makes. So, a couple of questions. One, how did the work ethic come about, and did you set this in the early 90s precisely because it was the best personal reference that you had as an author to draw upon, or...?
Number one, so I am, what was the question again?
Well, the question, I guess we were talking about, I threw many at you as a matter of fact. No, I wanted to ask why you set this in the early 90s. Did you feel that this was the best place to dwell upon because you were, as you sort of say, working in restaurants during the time, and this seemed to be kind of a better access point?
Well, I had some drafts which were set later than that, but for whatever reason, you know, when you're depicting a microcosm, it ends up just, you know, it needs, like, reference points to the larger world. And so I felt like I just needed something else going on, and I had, I had guys in there who had references to the military and whatnot, and so somehow in revising, I just started shifting around in time a bit, and, you know, the time thing, the first Gulf War started to stick, and it started to work. You know, in a way, the question you asked earlier, which I was trying to formulate an answer to, was about the work ethic, which... I mean, to me, I think is really important because all these guys are slackers in the true sense of the word, but that doesn't mean that they don't operate on an ethics or an ethos of a sort. So, I mean, he has that, and he has a justification, albeit a confused one, for what he allows himself to steal from the man, and what he thinks is crossing the line, and so, you know, somehow, just in the drafting, connections between the Shaka character who wants to go to war, and the Rick character who wants to go to war but can't go to war, and the army welder, and you know, the economic warfare, it just started to thematically come together. So it wasn't really by design.
There's kind of a couple questions from this particular point I have. And one is, I mean, you indicated that you would set this later. And I was wondering if this particular time period may have come about for two reasons. One, maybe you were sort of splitting the difference between your lived life and this particular character's life. And maybe this was kind of somewhere in the middle. And then you mentioned this, the war and the economics. You have the economic warfare in this, but there's also one reference to Katrina when she is named as a girlfriend you can, or a girl you can't imagine shitting. So there seems to me a kind of obvious modern parallel to certain events.
I didn't
events.
Pick up on that. You know, the funny thing about that is that so much of the early drafts, like in the detritus of the piece, band references, song references, and whatnot, from the early drafts in which it was set in, you know, a more contemporary time, hung around in there, and we actually didn't clean them up until it went to fact-checking, and they got this incredibly anal and wonderful fact-checker named David, and he busted me on tons of things, you know, making references to songs that couldn't have existed. He even corrected my spelling of the word putang, which is... I thought it was Putang, but it's actually Poontang with an N. So
well, there's also a debate. I was kind of thinking
it works miracles. There.
You have a character. You know, you have, I believe, Wen says my bad in this, and I was thinking to myself, maybe that might be a tad early for Florida. I don't know. It sneaked in there.
Could be. There is. I'll let you in on a secret. We, me and the editor, sort of made a decision that we'd get all the time references, we'd clean them up, we'd make them all accurate, but there was just one that I decided I really wanted to keep, and that's one of the scenes where he's having sex with the Marigold character after she broke her back, and he says that he imagines her as the full wine glass on the mattress and him as the bowling ball.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, this commercial, David found out, didn't come out until, like, 96.
Yeah.
But we decided to go with it anyway.
Sure. Well, I mean, going back to this idea of the larger scope in terms of Desert Storm is in this. Katrina, I had mentioned earlier, although I was clearly subconscious. But this larger kind of heft almost makes it kind of a piece that's almost parallel to our time. And I was wondering if this was kind of your intent in stylizing this particular time.
That definitely came out. I mean, once the design, you know, of the narrative content sort of revealed itself, then, yeah, I was thinking of it as parallel in many ways, but also very different. I mean, there's not a single cell phone in the book.
Yeah. So gotcha. Well, I wanted to also talk about something that's very interesting. I mean, this character passes out, often with Post-it notes affixed to his body. He clearly has been drinking to pass out. What I find interesting is that he very rarely makes reference to the fact that he is drinking. He often refers to others having king cobras in their hands, but there is actually quite a lot of peeing in this book. So
is that right?
Yeah. There's a considerable amount of peeing, and so it's almost as if what he decides to focus upon is not his the source of the problem, but the effect of the problem.
Well, it probably owes more to my bad taste than any conscious conscious move on my part. I actually didn't realize that.
Well, I'll revisit it.
I know that he pees on a pylon in the beginning.
Yeah, yes, he does. And this is the character who pees on him in the shower. He has the memory of his stepfather peeing on him in the shower.
Yeah, that's true.
There's constant references to peeing throughout. A lot of the guys just talk. I mean, I want to ask about this.
It's a given, you know. He's always got a beer. So whenever he's not working, and a lot of the time when he's working. So.
But in terms of not actually addressing, you know, I drank this or I drank that, was this a decision that you specifically made that you want to kind of isolate his alcoholism in some sort of way, or at least like prevent him from seeing what he was doing? I mean, it goes hand in hand with the post-it notes.
Yeah. Well, I think there's lots of things that he's doing subconsciously. So, I mean, that may be one of those. But, you know, like I say, I just feel like it's a given. He'd be drinking.
Gotcha. Well, the post-it notes are interesting because here you have this thing, going back to the work ethic that we were talking about earlier, people often associate post-it notes as helpful reminders for them at work, and here he is using post-it notes at home. And so I'm wondering how this post-it note scenario came about. Do you have any personal experience of waking up with post-it notes affixed to your own body, or what was the deal?
No, I don't, but I did. I've never stolen from a character before. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Oh, from a restaurant, you mean?
No. From a character. Oh. And so I actually borrowed the idea to keep post-its in my wallet from my character. And now I keep some in there and write on them. But I never did before that. How did the idea come about? I don't really remember. I think it started out, it was just scraps of paper. It was always scribbling on things. And I was trying to work in... I was trying to work in his poor spelling. For some reason, I thought that was important to just to give some kind of educational reference point. And, you know, at some point, it just became post-its.
How did post-its come into play in terms of, did you design this in there instinctively, or how did you relate it to the work ethic of his work ethic that came around later?
Well, post-it notes are just so... they're everywhere, you know? And everyone uses them, and usually, like you say, you use them in the context of an office setting, or you use them for some, like, serious purpose, you know? Mm-hmm. But they're actually pretty silly looking. And I mean, he empties out his consciousness there, so... I mean, in a way, there's nothing more important than that to him, especially since he has no other way of accessing it. So.
Yeah, but there's the symbol of the post-it note. I mean, these little post-its can be flown away rather easily because the glue is not exactly the sturdiest compound, particularly when you're talking about a human body surface. So there is something distinctly metaphorical about that.
Well, he keeps them. He archives them, yeah. Yeah, and you imagine, it's something that I don't go into a lot, but you imagine that, I mean, already they're barely legible, like, when he writes them, and so you can imagine after a few years of wear, like, he's reading the ones he used to keep notes when his mom and dad would tell him something, and, I mean, you imagine the condition they're in, so, it's sort of, I don't know, I imagine that it was, on one level, kind of sad.
Yeah.
You know, loss of memory is always kind of sad, because you lost something forever there.
Gotcha. When did the name Wen Thinfinger, where did it come from? I mean, we have an explanation in the book that it was a way to Shanghai the Polish surname, but why that name over anything else? I mean, it's not just about that story that the mother offers.
You know, I work a lot on names, and I just try and get interesting names that I think... that I think are really suggestive of character. And so I'll go through 20 names for a character. And very often, like, until I get the name, like, the story isn't working, you know? So somehow it's just a major part of figuring out a character for me. So where it came from exactly, I don't know. I just listening to different combinations. I liked giving him a name that was a common question word that was thrown around, because I felt that I could have some fun with it, you know, in terms of various situations when people would be saying, when are we leaving, or something like that. And, well, my editor, rightly so, cut all that nonsense out. So.
Yeah. not one for cheap jokes like that. Well, I mean, but it is an interesting name, because when I first read the book, I read this name and I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be right. Did he just introduce himself as Wen Thinfinger? Yeah. You know, I mean, it isn't until I sort of, you know, it's one of those names that you just can't quite believe. And was this kind of your intent to sort of show that he is this part of humanity that one cannot believe, or that is, you know, by way of being referred to as when in his life, you know, when in his life will he actually go ahead and accomplish something? Or questionably, is he accomplishing something? One can also successfully argue.
Right. Well, yeah, that plays a big part in the first name. But also, you know, there's the one scene where they explain it. His mother had trouble during birth, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
She was saying, when will you get the hell out of me? And when?
Sure.
So I would hope that it's layered in terms of meaning. You know, it sort of reflects back to the mom and dad situation, which always hangs over everything, even though they're never present in the piece. And, you know, like you said, you know, references to society's expectations about him.
Sure. I mean, it's one of the most unusual character names I've heard since hero protagonist from Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, you know?
Yeah.
There's something very interesting about Wen's use of proper nouns, and also nouns in general. He refers to, you know, the rob instead of, say, you know, the theft or the stealing or whatnot. He calls it the rob, which is very, very unusual. He also refers to cafe girl and guitar boy, and he calls his dad statistician, or I can't even pronounce it correctly.
Statistician.
When did these sorts of specific quirky proper nouns come into play for when describing his life and all these figures he sees that he can only identify really by these?
Well, with regard to the positions in the restaurant, I mean, that's just how things go in a restaurant. You know, people are totally reduced to their position, and very often the position, if they can't come up with a catchy name like Oven Man, you know, just whatever, Salad Bitch or Pasta Boy or however it is, you know. And so, I mean, I just lifted that from reality. I mean, that's what people do in the restaurants, and that's part of the, you know, part of the technical language of working that position. But the other stuff, I think, is just, you know, again, like the name, a big part of figuring out that character for me was just sort of figuring out his linguistic affect and, you know, trying to figure out how he speaks and how he talks and how he parses the world. So
there are also two economic scams that he does to make money that he describes in depth. And I'm wondering, it reminded me very much of sort of almost a noir novel to some degree, and it's which is, you know, how they outline the scam. And I was wondering how these scams emerged. Did you have any personal experience, or was this a kind of scenario in which you really wanted to articulate precisely how these characters go out and drink beer and the like?
Well, I think you're referring to the food stamps one.
There's
right?
the food stamps Probably. One, and there's also in the restaurant when he describes how he. How he shaves off. Oh, the 50 cents. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Well, with regard to the food stamp one, I mean, that one sort of came out because of the fact is it does double duty. It's another example of fucking the man, and it's actually impossible to do now, but there was a brief moment in time in which that was a very common thing. Obviously, someone caught on, and now the system works slightly differently. But, you know, a lot of the people I worked with back then were on food stamps and stuff. You know, a lot of people in that situation are on food stamps. The irony being that, like, one of the great perks of working in the restaurant industry is that you get free food.
Yeah.
But, the Taco Bell one I probably shouldn't address until I check various statutes of limitations.
gotcha. Although you probably are in the clear if this was like the early 90s, but still, there is something about stating these economic methods. It's almost as if they are referencing hidden economies that just really aren't talked about in literature. And was this your aim, to the economics of how these people acquired their items or their beer or their money, that this is as much of an important part of what they do as to who they are?
I think it's incredibly important to them. They don't have any money otherwise. They don't have any skills to really get well-paying jobs. So they're just scammers. They take whatever they can get. So
no, but I mean, maybe I should address the question more specifically. Yes, they are scammers, but you actually outline how they scam. Is this a matter of reflecting the patterns of working at a restaurant or the patterns of living this particular life and thus alerting the reader that this is the way that these people live?
Well, I definitely shouldn't slander all people who work in restaurants.
Oh, I'm not suggesting that we're slandering them here,
Maybe it's a compliment because they're so witty and clever. But no, I don't think there's anything really intentional by design. I just think those are the kinds of things that these screw-ups do. So they invest so much effort in, figuring out how to get a few bucks from one particular scam or another that, nothing of consequence can ever get done because all the mental energy is directed towards that.
There's a number of symbols in this book. They have Jenny Reagan's purple underwear. You also have the grenade, which thankfully, it's sort of, you live up to Chekhov's maxim on that.
Yeah.
But I wanted to actually ask you about having these very particular images throughout the book. Do you feel this was a way to provide a kind of literary heft to a particular world that is often not dwelled upon in fiction?
You think the objects give it a literary
Well, I think so. I think so. But I'm just curious as to, how these images manifested themselves during the course of writing Oven Man.
That's an interesting question. I don't really know. I just, again, it sort of comes back, with the Jenny Reagan character. I mean, she is that purple G-string, hiked way up out of her pants. I mean, that's just that girl. And that's the best way, I think, that you describe her. So whenever he sees her, that's always the first thing he notices. But with the grenade, I always had Chekhov in mind. As soon as I had Rick set that grenade in there, I knew what was required of me. So, it became a very conscious, to me, it was very much in my conscious thought all the time when I was writing. So
you didn't outline, you just wrote it along as it went along.
What's that?
You did not outline this book, you wrote it as it came.
Oh, I drafted a big mess of it, and then my friend Arthur Flowers, a great writer, blues writer, he told me that I needed to write an outline because it was just a mess and I was confused. I lost track of things, and I sort of had some outlines here and there that helped me structure it. But no, in the end, my process is one of chaos and disorder. So,
is that where you find the truth, in that chaos and disorder?
Well, I've tried to be really neat and orderly and organized about the work, but it just doesn't happen for me. It ends up being cold and uninteresting, and so, something about the disorder, Donald Barthelme has this thing he says about how he likes shipwrecks of sentences over, for instance, beautiful sentences, because shipwrecks grow barnacles and other interesting things happen there, mm-hmm. So there's something to be said for messes and decay and places where bacteria generates, so.
Gotcha. The name Piecemeal Pizza, is this an actual place, or?
No. I still don't like that name. I just never came up with anyone
like Ken's Barbecue.
Where, no, of course, no one was named Ken there, so.
Yeah.
There was something about, I think when I first came up with that, I was thinking, I actually was probably trying to think symbolically with the name of Piecemeal, but not sure what exactly I was trying to symbolize. Just you know, some like sense of fracture or something. I don't know. That the, you know, that there were parts to the whole. But it doesn't really make any sense.
Well, there's also there's something vaguely ideological about a T-shirt that says "Make food, not war." Mm-hmm. Going back to what we were discussing earlier about the kind of, I guess, larger scope of this, is that those T-shirts, are they part of that scope?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I hope works about those is the fact that they sort of come from this hippie aesthetic, which Wen hates about the restaurant and Scordilli and Jafari there. So, but yet at the same time, you know, it has resonance with, I mean, he never really addresses exactly how he feels about the war. He expresses, I think, a kind of fascination with it, but also an indifference and probably, in my mind at least, a cowardice about it. So, I mean, I would hope that those resonances are there whenever that word pops up.
One thing I neglected to point, but it just kind of popped into my mind, was in regard to the outline. Well, the taxonomy of different types of restaurant workers, I'm wondering, that's very outline-like in the way that he explains it. So,
yeah, but I think that's a true taxonomy. I think I would stand by that one unless someone wants to challenge me. I think that's pretty much how it goes.
How many Jafaris have you met there?
Too many. Too many.
Gotcha. Why use a $2 Huffy bike for the accident that that occurs in this book? It's almost as if it's sort of a kind of like child's instrument to some degree. So is this really a matter? But the book isn't really about necessarily growing up. It's about living through a particular sort of point in your life, perhaps before you grow up. But I don't necessarily think that it's about children. I think these characters know exactly who they are and where they're at, and so I want to ask you why you would use a Huffy bike, a very sort of childlike symbol, for the accident to actually befall. Or is it just something that is just stupid shit that kids do?
No, that one actually has a technical reason. The thing is that particular kind of bike, that Kmart Huffy,
yeah,
probably weighs, at least in my mind, in my experience with them, probably weighs about 60 pounds. In other words, it'd be near impossible to bunny hop this bike.
Yeah.
Even if she were doing it correctly.
Yeah.
So that was purely the intent in doing that. You know, also the thing would be, you know, Wen wants her to ride the bike. She doesn't want to ride the bike. He's trying to make her into a particular kind of girl. And so, you know, she would never, like, get a good bike.
Yeah.
So it has to be a $2 garage sale Huffy, and the irony then being that she can't, it's basically physically impossible for her to do on that what he expects from her. So.
Well, what's also interesting is, and I was alluding to this, is when comparing himself to the college kids later on in the book, but we don't actually know precisely what kind of age he is. He suggests that he's younger than 38 because Jafari reveals himself to be 38, but that leaves actually quite a lot of latitude for what kind of age he can be. And so I'm wondering, is this essentially kind of a chronicle of almost any sort of 20-something or what?
There is the fact checker actually figured out how old he was by doing some mathematics with regard to how long ago it's referenced that he got the tattoos when he was 15.
Ah, yeah.
And I forget exactly what that age was, but I think it was in the mid to upper 20s, like 26 or something.
Yeah.
Which pretty much how I imagined him. Mm-hmm. How I imagined him, but I never felt like it needed to be explicitly addressed. You know, sort of at that stage where you're kind of expected to be doing something and you maybe feel and maybe even admit to those pressures, but are still kind of unsure how to react.
So the actual circumstantial employment was more important than any age factors in writing?
Yeah. Okay. To me, yeah.
Yeah. There's one interesting thing, and that is the whole sleeping arrangement between he and Marigold. He doesn't seem to understand that, like, she cannot sleep in the same bed with him And this seems to me a very, very telling sign that the relationship is over.
Yeah.
And so...
Probably before the book's even begun.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the question then becomes, since neither he nor Marigold can actually kind of come to terms with this reality, although one of them, without giving it away, does later on, it seemed almost as much of a part of their lives as kind of being stuck, so to speak, in a particular service sector job. And so I wondered, was this kind of a sort of... Did this kind of come together? Were these tied together when you were designing the and weaving the plot of this? Or this goes back to my reductive work versus love scenario that I introduced earlier. And, you know.
Well, let's see. How to address that exactly? Well, she won't sleep with him because she dreams that he murders her, yeah. Right? So basically she's scared to sleep with him. So already, like, on page one, she's sleeping on the couch with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
So then when, you know, his grand plan to sort of... His strategy for, like, fixing all the wrongs is always, you know, to just, like, go full force at it. You know, so, like, when he felt that he was losing his attraction to her, he moved her in, right, mm-hmm. to the apartment. So when he feels that they need to address their, you know, their other issues, he buys her a very expensive bed. So, and yeah, of course, he imagines that they'll be laying there together. But then, in fact, when she comes home, she needs a special, like, you know, whatever you call it, striker, hospital kind of bed for her back. So he's just, you know, the guy has good intentions, but he's never also, quite works out.
He also has a rather narrow fidelity in terms of his relationship. Because he goes off of several girls throughout the course of this. So maybe it's about these characters not necessarily fitting into, I guess, the monogamous model that is considered, quote, normal, you know?
Probably not. I think he does that just because, you know, he feels that it's over and is looking, while also feeling tremendous guilt for that.
For messing up.
Yeah. Gotcha. Knowing that he's screwing it up more and more, but being somehow unable to stop that.
Sure.
That collapse. So.
Gotcha. I'm wondering in terms of this... the pizza owner, Scordelli.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you base him on anybody specific, or how did this character and Dr. Bob come about? They're rather idiosyncratic, not exactly heavies, but certainly people who maintain the status quo rather loosely in this pizza place, while also having these odd underworld connections. And they mention at one point, well, we don't deal with the police. And so I'm wondering, again, is this sort of pinpointing something about the economy that is underground, that is overlooked, that is just not dwelt upon?
Well, I mean, in any small town, as you probably know, I mean, you know, the people who have the sway over, you know, city councilmen and, like, various, like, boards of commerce and whatnot are all the local business owners, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to a degree, there's always an old boys network at work. You know, probably, but at least in this particular book there is. But, you know, with these guys, I needed them to be a little bit more than that. Mm-hmm. I needed them to be a little bit more evil just for the, you know, for it to be basically a more, for the stakes to be higher when people were...
So they served.
We're robbing the restaurant.
Served a kind of a conflict point then.
Yeah.
Things
and, you know, I obviously didn't want to tread into any kind of, you know, I didn't want them to be mobsters or something, but I wanted them to be menacing characters. So naturally, like, what's the most menacing occupation in the world? Obviously, it's dentistry. And what could be, like, more terrifying than a dentist who's no longer a dentist for... unclear circumstances, you know? So I was really happy with the design of him and then Dr. Bob. And then with Scordelli, you know, yeah, I mean, in a way, I had so many managers in various restaurants, and some of them are scary, man. Some of them, you know, I've had managers threaten to beat me up. I've seen managers like beat up other employees. You know, there's a power relationship there, and
yeah, gotcha.
You know, it can go awry.
It can. I mean, well, there's also a vague sort of Mengele idea with Dr. Bob. You know, we could have possibly come up from Argentina for all we know.
Yeah. No one knows where he's from. And so I'm real happy with him. Scordelia, I don't know if I ever really got him right, but...
The skate park project in this, it seemed to me kind of... interesting compare or contrast between Wen and his friend, because it sort of suggested that for all their slackerhood, there's something to work on. There's some passion to dwell upon. And I'm wondering if this was intended as a kind of a project that was could be used to compare the various lives of each other? Or?
Yeah. Well, Wen sort of wants to be... I mean, he wishes he had all the abilities and the savoir-faire that his friend Blaze has, but he just doesn't. So, you know, Blaze is that kind of guy who people just naturally, like, look up to and admire because of his physical ability and his character, and Wen doesn't have that. And so, but with regard to the skate park project, I mean, it's pretty... It might seem like a redeemable thing that he's doing, but really the only reason he's doing that is to further his goal of being in Thrasher magazine, because without the construction of that skate park, he won't have the facility which he needs to fill with rattlesnakes in order to get the Thrasher photog out there. So.
Yeah, but, well, simultaneously, though, it may be a rather superficial goal at this stage in his life, but it may actually lead him to figuring out what he does later. I mean, maybe that's a good sort of temporary locative point, and maybe the skate part is part of him figuring out where he goes and how he seizes the day on his own particular terms. That's why I sort of bring it up. I guess I have more hope for him than you do. So.
Yeah. Well, no, you're probably right. I mean, usually probably they'll go into construction or something, right? 10 years down the line, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe something else, but I mean they're not slackers in the sense that they can't do anything. They do have skills. They're just
Yeah. I mean if we're going to use more of the sort of, I guess, what a slacker meant in the early 90s was totally different from how it meant even 10 or 15 years earlier, where that type of slacker was more of a kind of loafer, whereas these are slackers who know exactly they'll take, I mean, Richard Linklater, I'm not sure if you have the Criterion DVD of Slacker, but there's this whole manifesto he set out on what a slacker is.
Yeah.
And a slacker will take a job knowing full well what he's getting into, will possibly have other pursuits like Wynn does. I mean, he can't sing to save his life, but nevertheless he's trying, you know?
Right.
And so I kind of saw him as a slacker of that type, in the sense that this is a stage in his life where he is trying to figure it out. He has at least some beacon. A superficial beacon, but, you know, anyway, we could speculate.
Well, I mean, Blaze is—he's a pretty industrious dude. I mean, already in the first 25 pages or whatever, he's making a bed to cover his whole floor because, you know, he loves sleeping so much. So there's a built-in sort of conflict there, right? I mean,
yeah,
basically, you go to great lengths to further your laziness.
Sure. The great irony there, too.
Yeah. Two Boots has great pizza. Can I just say that?
sure, absolutely. I'm wondering, in terms of talking about Blaze and Wen, the two things that they watch on television are the war and also the search for the Tasmanian tiger. This kind of goes back to my other line of questioning in terms of, well, they may not be able to perhaps see the full scope of the world, but they are aware, I suppose, in their own way, they are searching for tigers, such as they are searching for snakes.
Yeah.
You know, to what extent is this... I mean, this goes back to the work ethic idea, but to what extent is such active quests a part of these characters? And I mean, it's, in a certain way, it almost separates your book from a lot of books of this type, in the sense that there's something tertiary but definitely active going on. I mean, they do the work, and that's totally different from what the usual stereotypical depictions are.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you used the word Quest, which is also the name of his backpack brand.
That's right.
So, I mean, that kind of thing is always in the back of my mind. Yeah, they're definitely looking for something. But, you know, the Quest itself really isn't even, like, prescient in their minds. So, you know, that's why it has to come out in those kind of things, the things that they watch and whatnot. And yeah. It can't really exist in the book explicitly. So, but, you know, on the other hand, I mean, the discovery, like, what's, like, the most slacker thing possible? Sit around, smoke weed, watch Discovery with the volume down.
But it is Discovery, however.
It is Discovery, yeah.
And maybe it is Discovery, existentially speaking, with the volume down. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's much more meaningful than, like, even 1991 MTV when they actually played music videos or something.
Yeah. What of the faded tats? This seemed to me a very interesting scenario. Okay, it happens because he's passed out, but the fact that it is not successful, that it is not completely permanent, also falls in line with this theme. I mean, that there is nothing specifically locked into place in their lives, in Wen's life. And maybe and he does attempt to, you know, get additional tattoos later, but every time he tries to do this, it seems, whether by accident or deliberately, he can't actually get something exactly permanent. So what of this? Is this again? I'm trying to suggest that there's a lot going on here.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting read on that. To be completely honest, I wasn't really cognizant of that. I mean, to me, the tattoos are more about. You know, what I liked about his tattoos was the fact that they were, his marked, right? So he was, even in, nowadays, probably we don't bat our eyelashes twice at someone with forearm tattoos. But even 10 years ago, I think we did, 15 years ago. And so, you know, what was interesting to me about it is the fact that he was a freak to Joe Blow family, but also to, like, the people who he really wanted to be among. He has shitty tattoos, so they didn't respect him either.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that he was sort of caught in the middle there, between what he could never be and what he wanted to be. So,
well, there's also I didn't even touched upon the third nipple of Marigold, which I think is also very important.
It's very, very common.
Yeah, I mean,
third nipple.
It is, but there's also the incident with the, you know, twisted knife where there's the guy, is Blaze, I believe, right? Who's like taking and peeling off skin.
That's Shaka.
That's Shaka.
Who
I'm sorry.
Puts a cat's eye over his nipple.
Yes, yeah. But see, yeah. Here we have two sorts of different types of nipples in here. So it seems to me that when a theme along these lines appears twice, one should ask the author about it. So what of this?
I'm just totally obsessed with nipples.
Aren't we all?
No, you know what? I took a writing workshop. I took many writing workshops with this writer named Patrick Powell, who's one of the contemporaries. I mean, he's one of the few pure contemporary stylists in American fiction, like him and Sam Lipsyth are, you know, kind of on the same page.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just always says this thing about repetition, you know. He says, writing well is, all you have to do to write well is repeat yourself well. And so sort of my strategy really is, and I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be saying this because it sort of undercuts the possibility for meaning and the omnipresence of nipples throughout the book, but you know, to make it supportable, where else would I put the scarification?
Yeah.
It had to be on the nipple,
yeah.
Because it had to sort of reflect the third nipple. It just had to be basically a reiteration of it for, like, the thematic unity of the work, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I see it as a craft point rather than a sort of thematic issue.
So your suggestion to anyone writing is essentially just, like, come up with a vaguely literary metaphor, repeat it multiple times throughout your novel, and hey, the critics will love it, they'll go down to the readers, and then there's novel writing for you.
Well, okay, I don't mean to be so cynical at all, but what I do believe is that you know, if you have a lot of things going on, that is, like, you're paying attention to the language and you're generating, like, complicated real characters that hopefully you can, you know, establish some emotional connection with the reader to, and you have, like, other things going on, you know, then the repetitions, regardless of whatever meaning you might want there, I mean, the repetitions, like, accrue meaning of their own. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's the nature of literary art. Yeah. I think so. So, actually, in a sense, yes to your question.
Woohoo! So all this—it's basically—it's the job of critics and readers, I guess, to figure out. Anyway, well, that's very fine. Jeff, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Hey, thank you.